We'll come to order. This is a subcommittee on employee relations, and it is Monday, June 14th, 2004. I would announce, not that I understand this technology entirely, but we are being recorded digitally as opposed to on a tape. And I believe this is technology that the LCC is using, and I don't know if they're using it in the House. I think the Senate is looking at it, but so there will be compact discs as opposed to tapes. I don't know. There must be other benefits, Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and members, one other impact of this is that our practice has always been that once a meeting has adjourned, we make the tapes available to anyone who wants to listen to them. The difference in outcome here will be that we will be posting these minutes to our website so that any member of the public can listen to these proceedings.
So that is cool.
Is there a Beth coming up?
Yeah, right. We may not be on it, Senator Kane.
Legislative bloopers.
So, is there a motion for approval of the minutes of our March 19th meeting?
So moved.
Senator Gaither moves approval of the minutes. Any questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved. And we will move on then. Today we have the task of reviewing, and if it's the pleasure of the subcommittee to approve, the arbitration awards and also the contract in the case of the Correctional Guards Unit. Right now there's not a signed contract. I believe that's not a problem. It's just a matter of timing. With the law enforcement, the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association. So we do have the arbitration award there, but not the contract. But we do have both in the matter of AFSCME Council 6 Correctional Guards Unit. So do we want to have somebody explain to us what is in here? Mr. Larson, Ms. Pettis. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And members should have this in the packet, and I see you all have it. Yes.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Employee Relations. In that capacity, I also have the responsibility of overseeing the negotiations of all the collective bargaining agreements as the state negotiator. To my left and to your right is Ms. Jill Pettis. Jill is our compensation manager. And to my right and to your left is Amy McKee. Amy represented the interests of the employer during the period of time in negotiations with the AFSCME Unit 8 Correctional Officer Unit. In addition, I'm also here to give you the overview of the interest arbitration award for the law enforcement unit. So any questions that you have, I think we've got everyone here that should be able to answer the questions. With respect to the Unit 8 Correctional Officer interest arbitration, as you know, the AFSCME represents five of the what I would consider to be non-essential units, and we were able to reach a voluntary settlement with the other five AFSCME units on October 11th last fall. Unit 8, which is the correctional officer unit, is an essential unit, and they have the right to go to interest arbitration, and they so chose to do that. They did reject our offer and elected to go to interest arbitration. Our final offer to the correctional officer unit was consistent to the other units of which we've received voluntary settlements, and that is for those who were not at the top of the salary range, we continued to allow them to move through the progression schedules. They have annual progression. The officers rejected that final offer and elected to go to interest arbitration. There were four issues that were certified. The first issue was an across-the-board increase in the second year of 2%. The second issue was they wanted to maintain some of the old benefit levels in the 2003 Advantage Insurance Program. More specifically, they wanted the employer contribution to be at 90% of the family premium rather than the 85% of which we've received voluntary settlements with. The third issue was they were seeking a two-step inequity adjustment. That's a term we commonly use in labor negotiations, which would have provided an additional two-step increase to the employees at the top of the pay range. And then the final issue was an issue that both sides have been debating over the last two or perhaps three rounds of bargaining, and that has to do with an employer contribution for retiree insurance. The arbitration hearing was held in March. Thank you. March, and the arbitrator was Arbitrator Stephen Beffert. The state's position in this issue was consistent to the other voluntary settlements, which was no across-the-board increase each year. We continued to provide steps, so that was not a certified issue. That we felt that it was in our best interest to go into arbitration with exactly what we wanted to end up at. And so we did not certify the two steps. They were already a given. And the arbitrator was Stephen Beffert, and within a month we received the arbitrator's decision. And I'm pleased to report that the arbitrators sustained the employer's position on wages, insurance, and the two-step inequity adjustment. In other words, the arbitrator did not grant the union's position in that matter. And with respect to the retiree insurance, the arbitrator ruled that current language prevails, so neither side made any inroads on that issue there. I've had a chance to look at the information that is before you that was prepared by Mr. Hubinger. We've looked at that with our staff, and I believe that the summary reflects the other changes that were agreed to in negotiations. With that in mind, I will, if you have any other questions, I will be prepared to answer them, and if not, I have Ms. McKee who can give you a summary of some of the other things. If you have any questions with regard to other compensation issues, Jill Pettis can answer. So, Amy?
Yes, Ms. McKee. Hello.
Hi. My name is Amy McKee, and I'm a labor relations rep principal with the Department of Employee Relations. As Paul mentioned, I was chief spokesperson with respect to the Unit 8 agreement, although I would be begrudged to not mention the wide and vast assistance of my colleague Sandy Blazer with both respect to the negotiations of the agreement and the presentation and of the ARB award and of the arbitration case and the drafting of the employer's brief. For the first time, the Unit 8 did elect to negotiate a contract separately from the larger AFSCME Council. So at the AFSCME table that Mr. Larson negotiated were five of the AFSCME represented units, and Ms. Blazer and myself were at a separate negotiations table negotiating with the correctional officers. So they will, for the first time, have their own separate collective bargaining agreement. So that is a change from the prior agreements we've brought forth in the past. We did negotiate a number of issues with respect to this unit, reaching voluntary settlements. As Mr. Larson mentioned, the progression in both years of the contract and a 0% wage increase for the first year of the agreement. We also continued the deferred compensation match, which is approximately $175 per year. And we did include new language that would allow us to provide employees severance benefit payments to go into a post-health care savings account, which is consistent with the other units. Finally, one of the things that we also added to the agreement voluntarily was provisions in the paid administrative leave section, which would allow us to place an employee on paid administrative leave if they posed a threat or risk to themselves or to our facilities by coming to work. And if you have any questions about either the negotiated agreement or the arbitration award, I'd be happy to answer those questions.
Any questions, members? Thank you. It's pretty very clear.
Joe?
And it's very consistent with other agreements. Are there no members have questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I'll make a motion to approve the contract.
want to refer to the SCR 1, I believe, would be appropriate. That would cover.
I'll move the SCR 1 amendment.
And what it does is approves for the Unit 8, which is the Correctional Guards, the arbitration award and the contract, the negotiated agreement. And then for the Law Enforcement Association, it's strictly the arbitration award. We'll set aside the contract for the next meeting, and I think you're going to hold on to this approval until our next meeting, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, that is correct. The arbitration award for the law enforcement unit came in sooner than we thought. In fact, it was a week ago Friday. The staff person that assisted me on that contract, Trina Chernos, has left for other employment, which left me to get the legislative format in place and submit that to members of the bargaining team as well as the Law Enforcement Association. We did comply with Chapter 3.85, which requires us to submit the arbitrator's award within 5 days. However, we were just unable to be able to reconcile any of the changes or issues, and so we do not have a signed agreement for you, though I have been in touch with the Law Enforcement Association, and we do not have any open disputes left anymore.
I'm Representative Haas.
Madam Chair, just a procedural question. Since we've adjourned session, will these be ratified by the legislature next year, or would, if we would have a special session, would this be an item that would be ratified in the special session?
I'll let Mr. Hubinger. Okay. That. Explain that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hodge, these would be ratified at the next regular legislative session unless the governor called a special session specifically to deal with these contracts. So if the governor were to call a special session to deal with budget issues or a bonding bill, these contracts would not be taken up then.
Good. But Madam Chair, Mr. Hubinger, could that be part of the special session that we would also deal with the union contracts as we dealt with the budget? Could that be included? And if so, if that is the case, then maybe we should contact the governor's office and state that if there is a special session, we'd like to get these contracts ratified.
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Representative House, that would be perfectly appropriate. The warning would be that if the legislature adjourned that special session after considering them but not passing that bill, then these contracts and arbitration awards would be rejected.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Haas.
I think, I don't see where we would not want to pass these as a legislature because it's, we need to move on. This process has gone on with negotiating for over a year now. And we want to get these behind us and get, as not only legislature, but I'm sure the unions want to move forward, because they got next year coming with another contract. So if we can deal with them and get them done, if there is a special session, I think it would be beneficial for all. I just don't want to wait till 7 o'clock in the morning to do it.
Representative Haas, I think though, if there could be a special session without controversy, then I think we wouldn't have a problem. But I suspect that it won't be the case if we have one. So, I think the risk is that they not be dealt with, or that they be brought up and not completed, and then so it, being the conservative that I am, I'm inclined to, hold back on urging the legislature, if there is a special session, to consider them.
Then, Madam Chair, what will happen to, we got benefits negotiated, we got steps negotiated. Does all that hold off, or do we implement because we approve it today, and then everything retroactives back to last July 1st, and then will they just, hopefully we're going to approve this thing?
Well, that, Representative Haas, that's exactly how it works. It will go into effect. We need to approve it now for it to do that, but it will go into effect. And so the legislature obviously has to ratify, or else we go back to square one.
Right.
But, okay. Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, my understanding of the law has been that if we would not approve these in the next session that starts next January, or obviously if we disapprove them, if a vote failed, that we'd be back to square one. But that if we didn't take them up in a special session, we certainly could. We could ratify them, but otherwise they would be implemented. But I guess I was a little bit confused by Mr. Hubinger's discussion of consideration, and that if we would consider them but not pass them, then apparently they wouldn't be implemented, or we'd have to go back to where they were. I guess what's the definition of consideration, of actually voting them down, or someone simply introduces a bill but there's never a hearing?
Mr. Hubinger, or
I might defer to Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, the statute really isn't clear on that point, and it's never happened. What the statute says is that if this commission approves a negotiated agreement or an arbitration award, it shall submit the negotiated collective bargaining agreement or award to the entire legislature at a special session called to consider them or at its next regular session. And then there's a paragraph that talks about what happens when the legislature doesn't approve. And it's not very clear with respect to the special session. And there, I would think there'd be some discretion in the part of the executive branch to keep these in place if they felt. I mean, as long as the governor didn't call the special session specifically to consider these contracts, if he didn't mention them in his call for special session, then I think there'd be a good argument that they could continue in effect until the end of the 2005 regular session. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Paymar.
I'm not sure who this is to. I'm new to this committee, but I'm just curious about the state's matching contribution for the deferred compensation and why seems to be a disparity from unit to unit. I mean, is that just the way it's bargained out for each unit, or does Dewar have some kind of consistent policy about how much the state's going to match in deferred compensation?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, that is indeed the case. It's a fruit of the negotiations process. That is money that is a match that the employer puts into this deferred comp, and we cost it against the contract, and there are some unions that have devoted some enthusiasm in that area, and others that have not, and so that is a product of the negotiations process.
Thank you.
And members of the subcommittee, Mr. Hubinger points out to me that we probably should, before we vote on it, hear also about the law enforcement arbitration award, the Law Enforcement Association Arbitration Award, because that is part of the motion. Mr. Larson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the state offer to the law enforcement unit was also consistent to the other voluntary settled units. We provided for the continuation of step increases for those employees who are not at the top, and also the Advantage Insurance Program as well. I think successful round of negotiations with the law enforcement unit. We saw whatever issues that we had at the bargaining table. However, they were unwilling to accept the what has now been described as the wage freeze for the employees at the top. And they certified, the only issue that was certified for the law enforcement unit was wages. All other issues were either dropped or resolved during negotiations. The union was seeking a 1.5% increase to the increase of the ranges by every 6 months, so 1.5 increase on July of 2003 and 1.5 in January of 2004, 1.5 in January of 2004, July of 2004, excuse me, and then 1.5 in January of 2005, which translated into an increase in the ranges by about 6%. This, again, consistent with what our position has been, that we were not going to add any increases to the ranges, nor any across the boards on the table. In that case, the arbitrator was Arbitrator Richard Miller. The hearing was held in April, and we received the results back from the arbitrator, and the arbitrator sustained the employer's position and denied the union's request for the salary increases.
Any other questions then from the members? Representative Paymar.
I'm sure, are we going to hear from the unions at all on any of these,
I'm going to ask if anybody in the audience, is anybody representing these bargaining units here that would like to address them? Good morning, Senator Kelly.
Good morning.
I don't see any. We have the Haas
motion. Madam Chair,
motion.
I renew my motion.
Representative Haas moves the SER-1 resolution, which will approve the arbitration award and the negotiated agreement for Unit 8 Correctional Guards, and it will approve the arbitration award for the Law Enforcement Association. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the resolution passes, and we will then move on the agenda. Thank you very much. Thank you for all your hard work. Looking at HEZO, the Higher Education Services Office, I know we don't have Senator Pappas. I know she's out of town still, but you know, she would be interested in this and spoke to this. Members will recall that, was it at our last meeting that we approved the director's compensation? And so Ms. Hegard is here to explain what you have before us, what you're presenting here, and we do have a resolution here that will help guide members as well. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Lou Drosbach. I'm the Director of Human Resources at the Higher Education Services Office. And as you said, with me this morning is our agency director, Susan Hegard. I would like to take this opportunity, first of all, to thank the members of the committee for the opportunity to present our unclassified compensation plan for fiscal 2004-2005. This plan covers approximately 45 unrepresented employees in our agency, and we have a total of approximately 70 employees in all in MHESO. As you know, the Minnesota Higher Education Services Office became a cabinet-level agency at the beginning of 2004. Some of the proposed modifications presented to you today are necessary due to this change. As you are aware, the Department of Employee Relations has reviewed and approved our proposed 2004-2005 unclassified compensation plan as submitted to the subcommittee, and the Department of Employee Relations also calculated the cost of the increases. I will briefly outline the changes to the plan for 2004-2005, and then Director Hegard and I will attempt to answer any questions you may have about the changes. There are no across-the-board increases in either year of the plan. MHESO unclassified employees are only eligible for performance-based increases effective January 1st of each year. And this is a change. Previously, it was July 1 of each year, and that was changed to January 1 of each year. Such increases are dependent upon the availability of agency funds. There are no adjustments to the current salary ranges in the plan. In fiscal 2005, provision has been added for a deputy director position. Until the mid-1990s, the agency's unclassified compensation plan included a deputy position. It was deleted from the plan because it was not filled for a number of years. The range for the deputy director position is that used for other cabinet-level agencies, such as the Departments of Agriculture, Commerce, Employee Relations, Pollution Control, and Employment and Economic Development. The inclusion of a deputy director position in this plan will provide flexibility for the agency director, and filling it will depend on the availability of agency funds. Language modifications related to work schedule and salary administration are based on language and other compensation plans established by the Department of Employee Relations. Employees covered under this plan participate in the State Employee Group Insurance Program and are as provided in other contracts and plans. Doer estimates the cost of the increases, performance increases, FICA, retirement, and insurance will be 2.46 for 2004-2005 and will add 6.45 to the next biennium's base. We realize that these costs are higher than other plans and contracts. This is due to the fact that none of the employees covered under this plan are currently at the top of their salary range, and our performance-based increases are given on the same date of the year and are not spread out across the year like in some other plans. Finally, the actual dollar amount cost is estimated by Doer to be $152,000 for the biennium. We understand that any compensation increases will need to be absorbed by the agency. Director Hegard and I will be happy to answer any questions you may have about the proposed changes to the plan.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Drosbach. Are there any questions, comments from Representative Paymar?
Why wasn't the deputy director's position filled for many years? And if it wasn't filled, why do we need it now?
It was
Ms. Bach.
It wasn't available after it was excluded from the plan, but it was not filled. There was for some members that were here during the 90s, the agency was changed, abolished essentially, in 95, and recreated as the Higher Education Services Office. And at that time, when the director, the prior director, was appointed by the council, that individual did not choose to have a deputy.
Ms. Higard, do you want to address that question?
Madam Chair and members, I would. I'd like to just expand a little bit. I spent some time this morning on the phone with Kathleen Valenka, who's currently the chair of our council, and brought up the issue of a deputy position with our council. Kathleen heads that up when we last met, and they are in support of this. I ran through some of my arguments with her before I got to the meeting today, and I just wanted to share some of my thoughts with you as well. I think, you know, on the one hand, some folks may say, oh, you're growing government, and other folks here might say you're just trying to bring in more political types into an agency. But as you know, agencies are always a combination of people who keep the organization going, the responsibilities of government going, and basically kind of withstand various administrations. Then there's always a group of people who are more strategic in terms of their role in the agency, and kind of the balance of those two things hopefully provides good government services to people in our state. I think it's good management, and I guess I would just ask that you respect me, not as an individual, but as an agency head, whoever, you know, it's in my place later on, to try to set up the organization in the way that they best see fit. And the statute right now says that I'm supposed to be the next person is, but currently it's me. I'm supposed to be providing advice to the governor on higher education. Is it also wise for me then to be managing the agency? You know, we had a lawsuit last year. That took up an incredible amount of time. It doesn't mean that the director isn't necessarily engaged, but should the director have both of those responsibilities tied together? I think that in order to run an efficient organization, it would be helpful to have a deputy that I could look to for certain responsibilities and assistance. Right now, we're engaged in a strategic planning process. We brought management analysis in. I think I've mentioned this to some of you before. They are helping us do internal interviews of staff plus some external interviews of stakeholders, governor, certain members of the legislature, both parties, the heads of the education institutions in the state, President Brunix, Chancellor McCormick, and others, trying to ask what our role ought to be. I think the deputy position, at least getting that in place now, helps us once we get the recommendations from management analysis in place. Let's see. Right now, there are 6 direct reports to me, and this is not a slight to anybody in the organization. I have some very, very good staff working there right now, but I think the problem is that there could be a tendency to have some fragmentation. I think that's happened in the past when you've got 6 direct reports for management as well as policy going to one person, and so I think having a director position would help the efficiency of this organization. So I would ask for you to grant my request. If I don't need it, I'm not going to fill it, but I'd like to at least have the flexibility to do so.
Representative Knobloch.
Ms. Higard, as I'm looking at the write-up on this, I understand that your organization is about 45 employees, and at least the write-up I had here, which I don't think was prepared by you, is probably prepared by Mr. Hubinger, but it talks about other agencies that have got deputy directors. The ones it mentions all have, I think, a lot more employees than he so does. I guess I'm curious, you know, what other state agencies are there that have the number of employees of HESO, you know, in the 40s, let's say, and do they have deputy directors?
Ms. Higard.
Madam Chair and members, to my knowledge, I mean, the only analogy I would make is I used to work at the planning agency, which has also been the subject of abolishment over the years, and now it has been abolished. But when I was at the planning agency, I was the assistant director there. This is not commissioners often are in charge of larger agencies, and there's often one or two deputies plus a number of assistant commissioners. The request that I'm making is just to have I'm the director, and then there would be an assistant director, deputy director, basically, a number two, and then we'd have other managers, in place in the structure. But the Minnesota Planning Agency, to my knowledge, was also a small agency. I think Housing Finance is probably the closest agency to our structure, I think. They have similar responsibilities, although it's in housing, that we do in higher education loans and grants and that sort of thing. But I would say that's a similar agency, and they have a couple hundred employees, I believe. Is that right? Or 150 to 200 employees. But our total employment at our agency is around 70.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Hugard, I guess we don't have planning anymore. You just mentioned housing as having, a few hundred employees. Are there any agencies that you can name that are of the same size roughly as HESO that have a deputy director?
Ms. Hugard.
Madam Chair and Representative Knobloch, I cannot, but I think it's also important for you to look at, it's not just the number of employees in the agency, it's the responsibility that the agency has as well. We have a very large loan program that we administer. It's millions and millions of dollars of student loans. We also have a grant program. We have fairly substantial responsibilities. So I would just ask you to think about responsibility and not just about the numbers of employees. But again, this is just a tool that I'm asking for you to approve. It will help me run this agency better, I believe. And I ask for you to respect that request of mine, please.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Hugard, do you have are one of those six people who report to you now, is one of those people in charge of the student loan program?
Ms. Hugard.
Representative Knobloch, yes, one individual is responsible for the student loan program.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hugard, Ms. Dresbach said that the cost of the plan was $152,000. What are we going to stop doing in order for the agency to absorb that cost?
Ms. Hugard, because it does say in here HESO will have to absorb the cost, apparently, because obviously there's not there wasn't an appropriation of any additional money.
Senator Kelly and members, That's correct. We are going to be absorbing any changes that we make internally. We're not asking for any additional funds. But again, as I mentioned, we're going through this planning process this summer to help us understand what our role should and should not be. I'd like to then be able to have some flexibility to structure the organization, given the advice from external and our external customers and stakeholders. So I can't tell you right now what we won't do, because I think I'm waiting for that advice, just so it's not my unilateral decision. I'd like to wait for some of that external advice before I make any changes. But yes, it will not be any additional money that we'll be using for this purpose. It's just internal resources. And I think Ms. Dresbach had a comment, though, on the amount of money that was mentioned.
Ms. Dresbach.
Senator Kelly and members of the committee, the $152,000 it's my understanding when the Department of Employee Relations calculates that, it's based on all the number of employees in the agency that are covered by the plan. In actuality, only about 15 FTE are state-funded positions in this plan. The remainder of the positions that are covered under the plan are funded from other sources, such as federal grant monies that we received for running programs. The student loan program staff, our license and registration program fees pay the salaries of anyone in this plan that are covered under that. So not all of the employees covered under the plan are funded through state monies.
Madam Chair, I think it's important to understand that the $152,000 has nothing to do with the deputy position. That's not an amount that we're sticking in there to pay for a deputy. That's part of that amount would pay for the up to 2.75 and up point to 2.75 increases, correct, for current employees at the agency.
Senator Kelly, then.
Chair, Ms. Hugard, so that means that the cost would be the $150,000 cost of the plan plus the salary of the deputy director.
Well,
does that mean
there's no additional funding for that position, yeah.
Madam Chair, the Education Committee kind of cares what happens with respect to
Senator Kelly,
what we do with HESO. So my question is, you know, if this is going to cost us $225,000, I want to know what we're not going to do anymore.
Yeah. Senator Kelly and members, I think I was clear about this, but we're going through this process this summer to determine what our role ought to be. We're not going to be adding any new positions. There's going to be internal restructuring, but I don't feel it's right for me to do that unilaterally. I'd like to wait for advice from the stakeholders, like you and others, to tell us what we ought to be doing, what we ought to not be doing. Then we can restructure internally. But I can't tell you right now what we'll stop doing. I can't imagine that they're going to be programs that we're going to stop or actual things that we're going to stop doing. We'll probably manage some of this through attrition and that sort of thing, but right now I can't give you a response because we haven't gone through the strategic planning process yet.
Okay, Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hegart, I've heard you mention a couple times now that you're still in the process of going through some strategic planning to determine the task organization for HESO. What is to prevent you from coming back to this body or to the legislature at a later point after you've determined your task organization and ask, tell us, here is what I do not have, and here's why I need it, and ask us for an authorization at this point instead of asking us, particularly in this budgetary climate, to offer an open-ended appointment to a highly compensated employee who may or may not be needed?
Ms. Hegart.
Representative DeForest and members, I don't know when this committee is going to meet again. As I said, we're going through this planning process this summer. I believe that there's a need for deputy. I've informally talked to a number of kind of external stakeholders who have agreed with me. I think that it just allows me then to be able to run the organization the way that I see fit, and not have to wait, you know, a number of months to ask permission, you know, to fill a slot. I think the need is there now. It's just we're not clear yet about exactly how the organization is going to be structured, you know, until we get through this process. But it's now a cabinet-level agency. The governor, you know, supported it. There was bipartisan support for this. And so I guess I'm not clear on why it would be wrong to try to set up a similar structure to some other state cabinet-level agencies.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Hegart, well, the reason why I think this body cares in a bipartisan way is that we're talking about authorizing a position that may pay $105,000 a year in this budgetary climate. But my question is, I've become confused now. Is it your intent, if we authorize this position today, that it will or it will not be filled?
Ms. Hegart.
Representative De La Forest and members, you know, I think that there is a need for it, but again, I don't want to unilaterally just make that decision. I'd like to get some feedback from some of the external stakeholders before we make that decision. But just informally, in some of the conversations that I've had with folks, there seems to be some consensus that there's a need for a deputy position. And now that this is a cabinet-level agency, I guess I would argue that there's some justification for that. But I guess I just would like to have the flexibility from you to have this spot available.
Okay. Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Hegart, I know you've kind of touched on what I'm about to say a little bit, but I guess let me just understand. So in terms of the possibility of having this deputy director position, is it mainly you see the potential need for this as a way to run the department better, or is it mainly you see the need for this because of some new duties or changes that are happening and have been approved for HESO?
Ms. Hegart.
Representative Knobloch, members, I think both of those things. I think there's going to be a level of management that's required, but I think also there may be some roles and responsibilities that will be enhanced, maybe things that we're currently doing but we need to do a little differently or more of, and I'd like to have some flexibility so that the position probably would have some management responsibilities as well as some policy responsibilities.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Hegart, I guess what you're saying is you feel that whoever had the job before should have been spending more time on some other management areas that they weren't able to spend time on because of not having a deputy director position.
Ms. Hegart.
I believe, Representative Knobloch, that there are a lot of good employees at HESO. and I don't want to slight the previous director, but I think that some of the problems that occurred could possibly have been prevented if there had been a little more internal oversight, management oversight. And I also think that the individual heading the organization, the director, needs to be out there visiting campuses, working with legislators, and I don't know to what extent that was done as well as it could have been done. So I think that this provides me with a tool to help the agency do its job better and to help me do my job better.
Thank you.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Hegart, it just seems to me that when you're looking at a deputy director position and you're not entirely sure whether you'll fill it or not at this point in time, and you're also concurrently looking at strategic planning, it would seem that in the process of strategic planning, you may well even find other changes that are necessary within the agency, regardless of what size it is. It just seems like it would be a more orderly fashion to go through the strategic plan, decide exactly where the agency is heading and how and what they are going to work with and what they potentially may have to eliminate, and then come back and say, here's the restructure and here's why we need the deputy director, instead of at this point when there seems to be some ambiguities.
Ms. Hegart.
Madam Chair, Representative Senator Wergen, I guess my question is, when would you meet again? I mean, that's my big concern. Would I be left with a big gap between, you know, when we come up with our plan and we figure out what it is that we want to do and then when we have to implement it? And I don't want to be stuck having to wait to fill that spot. I want to be able to act quickly and efficiently. We've got to do our budget preparation this fall. I want to get somebody in there, you know, to help me with that. And I will have a gap during a very strategic period of time if we have to wait, you know, to fill, to get permission to have this deputy slot.
Ms. Hegart, I expect that the subcommittee will be meeting again maybe in August or September. We're going to have the engineers and the nurses arbitration decisions, I think, before us at that point was the LEA contract, which we've approved the arbitration award here, and then the State University faculty IFO is still resolved. So we will be having meetings, and I'm guessing not in July. No. So, Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, maybe a question for Mr. Hubinger. How would we modify the proposed or the draft motion to approve the elements of the unclassified personnel compensation plan except for the inclusion of a deputy director?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Senator Kelly, Mr. Schefter and I were just exchanging some possible language. We would suggest that on item one, rewrite that to say approve the unclassified plan as submitted by the Higher Education Services Office, but excluding the proposed new salary range for a deputy director position.
Madam Chair, I will move
Senator Kelly.
The SER2 draft resolution incorporating the language suggested by Mr. Hubinger.
Ms. Hegart, did you want to comment? Did you want to hear it again? You understand the gist of it, obviously.
I do, Madam Chair, members. I think that if that's the decision you've come to, you know, the sooner the better in terms of a meeting and having your ability to consider this.
And Ms. Hegart, I think it might be your case could be better stated once you've gotten the feedback that you're talking about and make the case. And I think there's time. I think the timing will work for the agency. So,
yeah, Madam Chair, I think an August-September meeting would fit our timeline. We should get the results of the report back sometime in August. I guess I just came here today concerned that we didn't want to have a big gap during a time period when we're trying to do some strategic planning and budget preparation for the next biennium.
I understand, but yes, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hegart, I think you kind of heard the discussion from members here that I don't think we're real comfortable with approving this today. But I think it'd be helpful, too, that as you start coming to your conclusions in that, maybe if you would email us or notify the members of the committee, I think it would be important to kind of bring us up to speed so we're not coming in here kind of cold on the issue. I think that, that would help all the way along. And I know the DNR went through a major reorganization, but they did it internally, no increase in costs and things like that, and it's to the positive. And I think that's what's being proposed here is some internal work with that and making the operation more efficient and better to serve the people. And but I just feel there's a level of uncomfortability in here. And so I think the motion before us to exclude it, and then we can come back later on this summer with all the details and then approve it. I think I feel very comfortable with that.
So Senator Kelly's motion is to approve the unclassified personnel compensation plan as submitted by HESO, but excluding the proposed new salary range for a deputy director position. And then after items two, authorize the proper authorities to implement the terms of the compensation plan as amended, and you would add the as amended language to number three as well. Any further questions or comments on that? Members ready to vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. And so we've approved the resolution. We've amended it from your request, but I believe we will be, I know we'll be meeting at the end of the summer, early fall. Yes.
Madam Chair, I think I'd like to have noted in the minutes that we will bring up this position as a discussion item once the study is done at our next meeting. So that it's officially noted in the minutes that we'll, so it's not, you know, there's no misunderstanding about this.
And Ms. Heger, I think the message is clear, just that the committee wants to see your, you know, a thorough rationale for doing this rather than just having an open-ended, maybe you'll do it, maybe you won't. Right. If you decide you need to do this, then.
That makes sense to me. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Jez Bach and Ms. Hegard, thank you very much. Members, we have a little bit more to go here. Third item here is asking for an update on contract negotiations. And yes, Mr. Larson, Mr. Shabatura. Shabatura, hello. Mr. Larson, which you gentlemen decide what you're...
Madam Chair, I'll speak on behalf of the two open units that we have remaining under the responsibility of the Department of Employee Relations. We have two units that we still have open contracts with, and that's the Minnesota Nurses Association, representing the non-supervisory nurses in our regional treatment centers, veterans homes, and correctional facilities. The offer that the employer has made to the nurses is consistent with what the other voluntary settlements were. In other words, continuation of steps, no increase at the top of the ranges, the Advantage insurance program consistent with what the other voluntary settlements were. We have been informed by the Nurses Association that they have rejected that offer and that they have filed for interest arbitration with the Bureau of Mediation Services. We are in the process right now of finalizing what the issues will be certified for interest arbitration. I would anticipate, and we've received a list of prospective arbitrators. We have not selected an arbitrator yet. My goal is to have that case arbitrated as soon as we possibly can, but just so you are aware of the timelines, once the hearing is scheduled, the parties typically take at least 21 days to submit the post-hearing briefs, at which point, upon receipt of the post-hearing briefs, the arbitrator has 30 days to render a decision. With regard to the other open unit we have is the Minnesota Government Engineers Council, which represents the engineers throughout the state. There are 850 engineers. Consistent with our other voluntary settled units, we have offered them the same, which is a continuation of progression for those that are not at the top, and the Advantage insurance program that was negotiated with the other voluntary settlement units. They took that out for a vote, and we were informed about 2 weeks ago that they rejected our offer. To date, I do not believe that they have submitted a petition to move to interest arbitration with the Bureau of Mediation Services, although I expect to get that in the mail shortly. And so we will be anticipating that unless something happens, that we will be going to interest arbitration with that group as well.
Any questions, comments? Thank you for that. Oh, Representative Haas, did you?
No.
Oh. Mr. Shabatura, you have an interesting...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Shabatura. I am the Associate Vice Chancellor for Labor Relations for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I'm here today to provide an update on the progress of our negotiations with the Interfaculty Organization. The Interfaculty Organization, or IFO, as we call it, represents all of the instructional faculty at our seven state universities. It's approximately 3,000 faculty members, about 2,500 full-time equivalents. MNSCU has negotiated settlements with two of our three faculty groups, and the offers made to all three faculty groups have been similar in structure to those that the Department of Employee Relations has negotiated with the other unions. These include the State Advantage Health Insurance Program with all of the plan design and premium contribution features, no across-the-board increases, and compensation increases that have been a mixture of steps within the range and lump sum payments. We did succeed in reaching agreement with the two-year faculty, those who teach at the state colleges, and our administrative and service faculty group on those terms, but to this date we've been unable to reach an agreement with the IFO. We met again with them last Friday, the 11th, under the auspices of a state mediator at the Bureau of Mediation Services. Both parties did introduce some new proposals in an effort to reach a settlement, but ultimately we didn't succeed in doing that. To fully explain where we are at this point, I'll need to provide a little bit of background or context for these negotiations. In November of 2003, we provided the IFO with a settlement offer that included the state health plan and compensation increases comparable in costs to those of other state settlements. The IFO had difficulty accepting this offer because historically they have received a contribution to dependent insurance coverage of 100% of the premium. That is, there was no employee participation in the premium cost. And ultimately, because the state's offer included the same 15% employee contribution to dependent coverage as with other units, the IFO was unable to accept the offer that we made in November. Because it was necessary to move forward with implementing the insurance plan for all state employee groups beginning in January of 2004, we canceled the IFO contract and implemented the new insurance program for all of the units, including the IFO. We did not have any formal bargaining sessions with them since submitting the final offer, although we did have some informal discussions with some of their representatives in the hope that we could break the deadlock and reach an agreement. The IFO then went to court and filed a lawsuit challenging the state's legal authority to implement the insurance program absent an agreement. And on May 11th, a judge issued a temporary restraining order wherein he found that the state's posture at the bargaining table, taking a firm position on the insurance contribution issue, was an unfair labor practice, and enjoined us from further implementing the new contribution amounts. We've therefore been working with Doer on the things that need to be done to implement or reinstate the 100% premium contribution if that becomes necessary. We've also had discussions with the representatives of the IFO, including their legal representatives, on alternatives, including placing the premium amounts into some kind of escrow account, if that would be satisfactory to the IFO and the court. We hope to make all of those considerations moot by reaching a voluntary settlement. The judge did specifically order us to return to the table and commence bargaining in good faith. We did that on Friday. We introduced some new proposals, which we hoped would help to lead to an agreement. They included some improvements on our previous offer on both economic issues and on non-economic language issues. The IFO, in turn, did offer to modify their position in some areas. While I think the parties' positions got closer than they had been, we were ultimately unable to reach an agreement, and that's the situation we are in now. Shortly after the impasse occurred in November, the IFO requested us to voluntarily agree to interest arbitration of their contract. We declined to do that. I think you all know, it has not been the practice of the state to voluntarily agree to interest arbitration with non-essential units. The mediation on Friday, this possibility was again raised by representatives of the IFO and was discussed with the mediator as well. They advised him that they were reconsidering renewing their request for arbitration. We anticipate hearing within the next few days as to whether or not the IFO wishes us to reconsider the request to submit the issues to interest arbitration. And that's the situation we're in at this time.
There are questions from members? Okay, I'm Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious your rationale for arbitrarily trying to impose this insurance plan. I mean, what has that been done in the past? I mean, what? I'm just trying to understand your rationale and why you weren't concerned that there wouldn't be a legal challenge to that.
Mr. Chavatura.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, the law does provide for, and there are practices in place for, unilateral implementation of terms of employment in the event that contracts are canceled and parties reach an impasse at the bargaining table. In order for it to occur upon implementation following impasse, the parties must engage in good faith bargaining to impasse, and whether or not that occurred is actually the subject of the legal dispute in part. It's still the employer's position that what we did was consistent with the law, although it would be necessary for there to be court proceedings on the underlying unfair labor practice charge in order for the court to make a final determination on that. The judge's decision to this point was only on the IFO's request for a temporary restraining order. We knew that moving forward with that, would not be favorably received by the IFO. We knew it was their position that they didn't want to accept the 85% voluntarily, and so it came as no surprise that they weren't pleased to have to accept it involuntarily either. However, by late November, it became apparent that the state was going to have to move forward with a consistent insurance plan for all the bargaining units, both the plan design and the premium contribution structure, and we simply did not have the luxury of additional time to bargain over it. As I think you know, insurance bargaining is by statute exclusively the province of the Department of Employee Relations. They have the authority, the exclusive authority to engage in that bargaining, to enter into or approve settlements on the insurance issue, and to implement and administer the program. And the information we had from the Department of Employee Relations was that the program needed to be in place on a statewide and consistent basis as of January 1st of this year.
Members? Gentlemen, we appreciate the update. Thank you. There are no further questions on that?
Thank you.
Thank you. excuse me. Then, members, the last item on our agenda today is the study. I don't know if you all recall that we did actually pass this. we did enact a study. We've talked about the issue. I realize that a lot of the members here are new, but it's been going on for a number of years. The discussion has about the salary cap that we have in place in Minnesota, and we're all familiar with that, with the topic, but we must do a report and have that report for the next legislative session. Or the timing is, I think, January 15th of next year. And so that means that we need to organize that study. I'm going to suggest that it be open to all the members. I expect we'll have two or three meetings, probably three. Mr. Hubinger and I have talked about it just briefly. Let's say three meetings, obviously between now and January 15th. And it won't be the official subcommittee because we're going to have to incorporate other organizations. And so it will be a working group, if you will, that will include representatives of the League of Cities, Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, counties, etc. All of those entities would like to have a place at the table and have their input, and we need that input, I think. So I'm going to suggest that we have it open to those of us who are able to be there and participate. And then we will develop out of that a report. But I think first we'll be getting information because it says that we need to have comparative data from other states. We're going to try to assess the impact on salary structures and recruitment and retention. That's always mentioned when someone comes in for a waiver. And then look at alternatives, whether or not we eliminate it or modify it, whatever we decide to do in the end. But does anybody have any comments? Does that seem like an appropriate way to proceed? I thought I had something. Senator Kelly.
So, Madam Chair, the composition of the oversight group for the study would be members of the subcommittee who choose to participate, the commissioner, and then representatives of the local government associations. That's how you're envisioning it?
Senator Kelly, yes. And in fact, if you have the actual, Section 30 there, that was the language we actually passed, and it names, it includes those. I don't know if there are others or if there is anybody else that would be interested in being part of it, but at least it will include these organizations that are listed here, and you're right, the commissioner.
And Madam Chair, the only reason I was double-checking that was that since the language was phrased as consultation with the commissioner and the various groups, one wouldn't necessarily have to have them be part of the oversight group. But I think creating a working group where multiple folks are participants rather than just consulting makes sense. I just wanted to clarify your
intent. A good observation, Senator Kelly, because actually we've actually had consultations. Every time we have a request for a waiver, they give us their advice, and we say, but this is the law, and we deal with it in varying, we have varying responses, obviously, to those requests. So this is, I think it would be better to have people sitting at the table talking together. Representative Paymar.
Well, Madam Chair, I just play devil's advocate. I mean, all of the organizations listed here support lifting the cap or eliminating the cap, so except for the commissioner, so I'm not
no
sure.
Small entity unto itself. You
know? But and I'm not sure if this is the extent of organizations you want involved, if this is going to be the group that's going to come up with the study.
Well, Representative Paymar, I don't think it's exclusive. So if there's anybody else that wishes to come and meet with us and have their say, I think that's highly appropriate. It just says that it will include these. It doesn't exclude anybody. Yes, Representative Knobloch.
But, Madam Chair, I guess I think about, one group that I know represents my city or a number of cities that I represents, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Now, I see they're not named. I would hope that they would be consulted or at least given an opportunity to testify, but are you saying that they also can be a member of the committee if they so choose, or that they would merely have a chance to testify?
Representative Knobloch, I think we'd invite them to be part of the working group, and thank you for pointing that out.
And, I guess I just used them because I could think of them off the top of my head. There may be others that I can't think of as well.
Madam Chair, there's the Minnesota Rural Colony Coalition also.
Okay. So Minnesota Rural County Association.
Coalition,
I'm sorry. Anybody else? Mr. Stranger. Yes. And there's a representative here from the League of Cities, Ms. Offerdahl, who wanted to speak to us on this. And then I don't know that anybody else has asked who, but I think the League of Cities is one of the driving forces behind getting us to this point to have this study. Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, while we're getting ready to hear Ms. Offerdahl, one of the things that I think, and maybe it is something you're anticipating, is if we could see where the cities and counties are in relationship to the 95% cap, in other words, a spreadsheet, if you will, from the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Cities, which should encompass most or all of them, and so that we can see there's more than just a 95% dollar amount to be thought about. There's also benefits and such things as that play into the equation. So if we could see basically a spreadsheet of how these folks are currently compensated from the lowest to the highest, we can see how hard we're bumping this cap, if you will, and we can also see what other compensation they're getting other than salaries.
Yes, Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Wergen has a good point. In the past, the staff has provided us with a spreadsheet showing the positions where we have granted a waiver in the past. And what we haven't had are those positions that might be creeping up towards the cap, as Senator Wergen was suggesting. So maybe we'll need both sets of data.
And I think generally that's been provided by the people seeking the waiver, Mr. Fubinger.
Madam Chair, members, we've received information usually from market studies that they've done in jurisdictions outside of Minnesota that would support the need for a higher salary. We do have some data on other Minnesota officials, but it's not as comprehensive as the list that you're suggesting.
Madam Chair, a second little piece to that. I do know that in some instances, local units of governments have little contracts besides the salary, if you will, and I think they should be included in the whole comprehensive data.
Well, and Senator Wergen, that's part of the issue. That's part of the controversy because the law requires that all of that be included, actually, but it just pits it against the governor's actual salary, you know, without excluding any benefit. Representative Knobloch, we'll get to you, Ms. Offord, also.
Madam Chair, just so I'm clear as the way the study will work, then I guess I'm kind of following on with Senator Kelly's questions. As I understand it, okay, you're going to have a working group. It seems possible that that working group may have a majority of interest groups on it. If you're looking at, you know, each representative of the interest group having a vote and, you know, there are maybe six or seven here. I'm not sure that we're going to have the attendance of a majority of members here, given the summer and the election season and all that. But then whatever that working group is going to recommend, this commission is going to then vote as a whole, all 10 of us, on what we're going to forward. And then the Legislative Coordinating Commission as a whole is going to apparently take that recommendation, the way I see this language written, and then do a vote on whatever we recommended as a subcommittee to them, and that is the report that will go to the appropriate committees. Is that the process?
Representative Knobloch, I'd say yes, although I think I was looking more toward consensus kind of procedure rather than, you know, up or down votes. I mean, we'll probably have to vote on some things, but Mr. Hubinger, how do you...
Madam Chair and members, I was imagining that the report would include a lot of the data stuff, but also include a number of options or alternatives, and so it might or might not include specific recommendations for any one particular decision about what the legislature ought to do or the LCC.
Right.
And Madam Chair, I think that's fine. I guess I'm just at some point there's going to be a vote of some kind, and it sounds to me as I read the law that there are going to be multiple votes, and I guess I just wanted to get a sense for who is voting on what when.
You know, and Representative Knobloch, I don't think I haven't thought that all the way through. It's a good point. I mean, obviously, consideration we have to give, but Mr. Hubinger, do you have anything else?
And Madam Chair, members, I point out that the report requires the LCC to conduct the study. Officially, the responsibilities regarding labor relations are to the LCC, which in turn has adopted a resolution delegating all of its responsibilities in this area to this subcommittee.
Okay.
I'm not sure if the subcommittee would want the LCC to meet and deal with this issue as well, or if the work of the subcommittee would suffice.
Okay. So, Ms. Offerdahl.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Offerdahl. I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll keep my comments very brief. I just wanted to draw your attention to the two handouts that were sent around to members of the commission. First is a memo that indicates the support of the League for this study and our interest in participating throughout the summer. It identifies some resources that we have at our disposal, including salary surveys that the League and the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities conduct each year. Those surveys do look at benchmark positions in small and large cities and provides salary and some benefit information, so we could certainly use those as a basis for developing the spreadsheet that Senator Wergen mentioned. Another potential resource that's mentioned in that memo is a survey that's conducted by the International City and County Management Association, which is the international group of city and county managers. They also conduct an annual survey that includes some good information that may help the working group look at comparative salary and benefit data. We also do offer in that memo our assistance. We would like to be as supportive as we can of this process, and we are certainly willing to provide contact information or get as involved as helping collect and evaluate data. The other piece that was handed around is our magazine article. It's our May edition of the Minnesota Cities Magazine. It includes a series of articles that feature background on the value of some different issues going on, and it's dealing with the value of public service. And one of those articles explores the compensation limit law and looks at some of the challenges that cities are facing with as it relates to the compensation limit. It includes some perspectives from four former city managers that have left Minnesota for positions in other states. Also some an interview with a city council member and with a recruiter that works with some of our cities. Might be some useful background for members. as was mentioned here earlier, we have supported in the past, we have a position supporting repealing the salary cap or substantially increasing the compensation limit. Ultimately, our goal is to really encourage quality public administration, so that's why we're really interested in participating in this process. And while many policymakers have been sympathetic to our concerns and the issues we've raised over the years, some still would like some more comprehensive data, and we see this study as a good way to develop that data and to help legislators to evaluate the current process and what changes might be needed. With that, I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Members have any comments or questions or any other suggestions for the kinds of things we or groups or things we might want to look at in the study? Ms. Offerdahl, thank you very much. And we will probably, as you heard me say earlier, be meeting again in August or September, and that we'll stay tuned for the working group. We'll try to work that so that it doesn't interfere with other things people might have on their minds, particularly House members.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gaither.
Are you suggesting that you're going to ask for volunteers, or are you going to?
I think that we will just everyone will receive notice of the working group, and I mean, if in any case, even if you choose not to be part of it, you're unable to be a meeting, you certainly can come to it. You know, two of the three or one of the three, whatever, but I think we'll be meeting about three times. That's not set in stone, but I'm guessing that that's what it will probably take. And so everybody will be welcome, and we'll incorporate a couple of the other organizations. And if you have other ideas, I think Mr. Hubinger is a good person to let know. And with that, we'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
And those in favor of adjournment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much. Mark, thank you.
Well, all right. See you again.